Okay, good morning, everyone. Let me go ahead and call the City of Mesa Council study session for Friday, August 23rd. I had already switched over to August 27th, and I thought that's the wrong date to order. Let's go ahead, and the first item on our agenda is to review the items for the August 27th regular council meeting. You can find that in your packet. I don't assume there's anything on page one, page two. Yes, Scott.
I have a question on 4B for the helicopter parts. Chief, I see Chief Gascon out here. Chief, I thought it's, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought at some point you had considered eliminating the rotor aircraft for fixed wing. Is that still in the plan, or if we decided that that wasn't going to work?
Well, we never talked about eliminating. The thing that we're exploring is creating a hybrid aviation unit. There are certain areas where a rotor is an absolute must. We do rescue operations with the fire department. Sometimes we flare buildings, for instance, to determine whether there is a fire. There are certain things that a rotor is more practical because you have to get down lower. But we believe that with current technology, that we may be able to have a hybrid aviation unit with a combination of fixed and rotor and do some of the patrolling with fixed wind. Another thing that is being is still very preliminary, but the discussion of possibility of creating a regional aviation configuration. There's an interest in other cities around the valley in having air support, and we're clearly the best situated in order to provide that. So there are a lot of things that are in exploration right now, and you know, the Fusion Center is a perfect example of creating that kind of the regional cooperation. But we should always have rotor, and I would never advocate getting rid of rotor. Frankly, we need to just have increased coverage. We today have about 12 hours a day. Personally, I came from a place that had nearly 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I can tell you, having been in patrol and requesting air support to go into search, you know, to help us with the building on a Friday night and not having the unit because they had to go down for fueling was not something that I was really happy with, but we only got one unit. Again, I was used to having at least two units up in the air all the time. So,
okay. I'm glad to hear that. They used to practice over my house. Please do not report. They, you know, don't do that anymore.
I don't know whether you know it or not, but we put your name on top of the rooftop so the guys know.
I figured they knew where I live. Thanks.
Just members of the police committee, I hope. That's page, yeah, page two, page three. Rex.
I believe I have a conflict at 4F. I own property on Falcon Field, and this fence will be within 300 feet of the property line, so I'll declare a conflict of interest. And the same thing on the companion one. I think it's 8F7.
Okay, on 4D, it looks like it's about a two-year payback if it's not a leased or rented piece of equipment. Is that correct, that this sound system, or do they, is it in the accounting that way also, so that the money that's currently being allocated for rental will be somewhat set aside to purchase this unit?
That's correct, Mayor Hawker.
Okay. That works then. I think it's a good purchase if you get a two-year payback on it.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, that's page three. Page four. I believe I have a conflict on 4-H. That's probably why it's off. All right, so I'll declare that on Monday. Anything else on page four? Page five. We have some introductions of annexations, introductions of zoning cases. Page six, resolutions. Continuing on page seven, I'd like the intergovernmental agreements between the City of Mesa and law enforcement training. They're on 7I and J and I think K, so that's good to move those forward. Rex?
Yeah, I declared a conflict on 7H already. So.
Okay. Right. Scott?
A question on 7G, if we have somebody from transportation here. Dan,
see you in the audience.
This is the area, 7G is over at Mountain Road in Warner. We have had, this is in my district, a lot of development in this area, and it creates some transportation problems because you're backing on to the GM proving grounds. So this is one of the another one of the improvements in this area that help with the flow of traffic, and I think eventually will also help when we start developing out. We have a public-private agreement with one of the home builders over in this area for the completion of Elliott south of Warner. I was wondering what the time frame on that was.
I know it's underway right now, and frankly, apologize. I don't know the exact time frame when it's going to get built out.
And that's going to be both north and southbound, right? I mean, the whole road's going to be developed?
At Signal Butte.
Yeah. And the reason I ask that somewhat silly question is because when I look at the map, it doesn't look like that. But I know that can't be the case.
Mayor Hawker, Councilmember Summers, the big development is on the south east corner. And so that'll build the large portion of Elliott and then the south leg of Signal Butte. And as you know, on this particular item, we'll be signalizing this intersection. And that's why it's on here, because we need to add a little pavement to let that to have that signal operate properly.
And then a left-hand turn signal heading toward the loop?
There won't be a left-turn signal, but there'll be a left-turn lane so that those left-turners don't block the through traffic.
Okay.
Because one left-turning vehicle wouldn't allow anybody else to get through.
Okay. Any idea when this project might be completed?
The signal, we're coordinating with the development, so I expect it this fall yet. It's on our signal schedule, so the design is underway, and we can install it pretty quickly.
Great. Thank you.
Just to follow up on that, during commuting hour, the traffic's backed up a long ways there. Why aren't we doing a left-hand turn lane signal?
Are you referring to the intersection of Signal Butte and Elliott?
Yeah.
The left turns, the backup is for primarily through traffic westbound, and it backs up about a half a mile to Mountain. So there's currently an always stop there. When we put the traffic signal in and it goes green, they'll all flow. And as a matter of fact, we've added a westbound right turn lane, as well as Councilmember Summers know, and that's helped cut down on that as well.
Just keep an eye on the left-hand turn. That area is growing really rapidly.
Absolutely. So if it meets warrants, we put in a left-turn area.
Thank you.
We also added Dan helped get a right-hand turn lane on Elliott heading westbound.
Correct.
That made a huge difference in traffic flow out there. But this is... We're slowly catching up with our infrastructure, but this is a sign of how difficult it has been to manage budgets and keep up with growth. This area has needed some road improvements and many others, and we're starting to finally, I think, catch up and provide some relief and services, but a lot more to do. Thank you.
It's page 7, page 8. Yes.
Is this for... I think we got a letter on this case. I'm going to be meeting with both parties, on 8B, the zoning case down in East Pecos Road. The developer and the neighborhood have agreed to meet with me. I have a meeting with them on Monday afternoon. I set this up a couple days ago. And so they're going to ask for a continuance of 1 week. My hope is that we can resolve some issues with this and bring it forward to council for final approval soon thereafter. I also received an email late last night from the neighborhood group asking that we establish a meeting with them between myself and all the parties. I want them to know that we've already done that, and we will be having that meeting on Monday.
Okay, is this related then to item number 9A? On the
item 9A is a...
The appeal of the design review case?
It's a design review case, which is the property next door, and there's no request to continue that at this point. We'll have a discussion about that as well in that meeting. Hopeful that we'll be able to resolve that quickly. I don't think the parties are apart on that issue, so I anticipate we'll be able to come to a vote on that.
All right. This is surrounding the Queens Park residential subdivision underneath the flight pattern.
Yes, it's south of the Williams Gateway Airport and surrounded by industrial property, yes.
Okay. All right. Vice Mayor.
So we can keep that on consent for a date certain. It'll be continued to September 4th. Is that what it is? Is that how it's going to be?
Yes, Mayor, Vice Mayor, that is the request for a continuance at this point to the September 4th meeting.
Thank you.
And that's agreed by the applicant and, okay.
Yes.
All right. This was a concern that I think a lot of council members had with the Queens Park residential area going in at the end of the runway. And I thought it would do more with overflights. The noise complaints and stuff, they, you know, 1 acre lots or larger. There really haven't been as many noise complaints as I was concerned about, but there's a complaint every time you want to develop industrial land that's across the street, and it's an industrial center. So I think, you know, some of the setbacks that have already been agreed to are more than I would have requested from the developer. So if you build a residential area in an area that's not appropriate, then you're going to have some incompatible land uses, and that's what we're facing here again. So I hope we use this case, not only the overflights, but the incompatibility with industrial and residential as we look at the area around Williams Gateway. Councilmember Griswold.
That's one component of annexation. A lot of times these are built in the county and then jump into the city, and they don't match what we have planned. When you're surrounded by industrial, it's not a good living situation where you have, you know, heavy manufacturing right next to housing. But where the county allows something in the middle of a already planned manufacturing zone, we can't stop it. And it makes problems for future councils for years to come. And we have it in the commons, we have it in a couple areas where it doesn't make sense on zoning. But it's because we have to accept what the county zoned it as when it comes into the city. So these are the conflicts we're going to be stuck with until we can get our annexation done and be able to get things making a little more sense for our city.
Okay, that's page 8. Anything else, sir? Page 9, additional zoning cases. Continued on page 10. And page 11, Vice Mayor.
What happened to the legal protest on 8K?
Mayor, Vice Mayor, the one of the properties that had early on filed a protest has since been sold, and the current owner of the property that is within the protest area is not opposed to it. They've said affirmatively that they don't have a problem with the case.
So, okay. So there are some people who protested who still are protesting.
Right, but it's not enough to meet the requirement.
Okay, that's what I need to know. Thank you very much.
So a protest is different than an annexation petition. Once you sign it, so there's different rules you can add and subtract from a protest petition until the night of the council meeting. How does that work?
We have a requirement that signatures have to be in place Monday week prior to council meeting.
Okay.
So it all had to be worked out by this last Monday. Right. Yeah, from that point, it's set.
Okay. Thanks. Scott.
The last item on this page is 8M. Is there anybody that represents the owners here? And while we're trying to figure out if that's the case, as I read through this is another apartment complex. It's requesting rezoning to turn into condos. And from what I'm reading, we're getting the replacement of dead plants and some paint. That's it.
Mayor, Councilmember Summers, in that case, this case, that is true. The conversion process by state statute doesn't really allow us to request very much in terms of bringing things up to what we would like to get in a new construction.
Okay. So we're not they're not interested in bringing it up to current codes, creating any, are there going to be any changes to the mechanical systems? Is there an engineering report on the mechanical systems? Are they old? Are they new? How old is this apartment?
Mayor, Councilmember Summers, I don't have that information available with me today, but I can check into that and let you know.
Are we required to allow this? Looking at the city attorney, are we required to allow this? This is a zoning change. Can we not say no to a zoning?
A rezone is a legislative decision within the discretion of the council. What the state statute says is that a property converting from whatever type of ownership to a condominium ownership, you cannot impose additional regulations on the condominium ownership that you did not require on the original ownership.
Okay, so we can't require an engineering review, look at the systems, an upgrade in the building codes, but we can just say no to the rezoning?
Yes, basically. But the council would, obviously, we have conditions in place in terms of what is the council supposed to look at when making a decision, but a rezone is a legislative decision within the discretion of the council.
Back to the issue of the plants that they want to trade out, is this not a code compliance issue?
Mayor, Councilmember Summers, yes, it is ultimately a code compliance issue. If they're not maintaining the landscaping that was originally approved, okay, we can't approach it in that route.
Hardly a trade. And maybe that's not the way it was intended, but it also, when I read this material, it sounded like a trade. Well, we'll give you new plants, replace some trees, slap on a coat of paint, and we're requesting the rezoning so we could sell it. I have mixed feelings about these things. First of all, I think the condominiums, even though we're having some issues with being able to build new houses, the home builders will tell you it's a really rough market right now. Quite frankly, housing, affordable housing for brand new police officers, firefighters, teachers, being a firefighter myself, I think back, I bought my house 14 years ago for $110,000. You can't even find barely a condo for that. And the starting salaries, all the police officers are looking at me right now. The starting salaries really haven't risen to the extent that the cost of housing has. And so it's hard for new officers, new firefighters, and new teachers, and new attorneys, because Tom's staring at me right now, to afford these things. So in that respect, it becomes entry-level housing. Where I have a problem is for the city's perspective, even a little bit from public safety. Now, instead of having one owner responsible for the entire property, we get 200 owners, 300 owners. I don't know how many units are here. And very little in trade. And it surprises me that we're seeing a case like this, because I know that Scottsdale has switched from, they had some units coming forward for conversion, and then they ended up going back to apartments because there wasn't the market for it. So it surprises me a little bit that we're seeing this. The other thing that concerns me is you get a lot of speculators and not so much affordable housing units. You get over 30%, sometimes up to 70%, you get over 30%, and they become non-warrantable condominium units, which means they have a harder time getting loans for these things. And there's no way that the city can guarantee it. I don't think that we should regulate that. But again, it causes concern. When you have a high degree of absentee owners, we get back to the issue of code compliance and properties aren't kept up. Well, who's going to maintain that? Is there an HOA here? Is there a bank of money when the roof starts leaking that somebody's going to maintain it? How is that going to happen? There's a lot of unknowns. John wants to say something.
Not really. But Mayor, Councilmember Summers, there is a requirement in the statutes for establishment of what's equivalent to a homeowners association when these things are set up. The details of it, though, I don't know.
So at least we're getting that. I'm not all that excited about it, so I think if the owner is watching or his attorney is watching and would like to set something up with me to discuss it, that would probably be a very good idea. And at this time, Mayor, I want to pull that issue for consideration.
Okay. Vice Mayor, I know we've tried to do this through some legislative action when it was coming up to try to make sure that there was some sustainability portion of the unit, whether it be a pool or a common area or something else that kind of converted it from an apartment where you move in and out to a long-term living situation, and were not effective convincing the legislature that sustainability was an issue they should consider. And I would imagine that the police department is thinking, oh great, another one of these. So I'm glad to know that it can be denied. I thought that there was going to be some type of protestable issue on the denial, so I'm glad you pulled it, because I read it and thought this is the one where we got caught by the legislature and cannot deny them if that's the conversion they're making. So,
and Mayor, I will bring that statute back. I apologize, I don't have it with me today, but what I will do is I'll take a look at it and I'll circulate it for the council as well.
Okay, good. Vice Mayor.
Thanks, Mayor. Thanks for giving that history, because, yes, we have tried to do something. And the problem is that we have some that were built this way as condos, and we know what we're dealing with already in those areas in terms of police enforcement. If they are not properly amenitized, if they aren't built well so that they sustain well. We end up with a whole lot of problems that aren't issues of leaky roofs. They're issues of the police having to go out on calls for service over and over and over again. And unfortunately, in some of those, we've ended up with, you know, a lot of criminal activity going on there, and it ends up being a real burden on the taxpayers of the community. My question is, if we deny going from R4 to R4 PAD, what's the impact of that in terms of the ability of their scheme, and I'm not using the term scheme in a pejorative sense, but of moving from rental housing to ownership units?
Mayor, Vice Mayor, one of the things that they're doing a little bit differently here that I'll need to check on for Monday to see what the impacts might be is they're actually going to a townhome instead of the straight condo type project. They're creating the individual lots under each of the units instead of all that being in common. And so that's why they're having to rezone. So if you deny the rezoning, they can't make it, they can't develop a townhome approach. They'd have to go to a more of a straight condo type process to make them ownership units.
But they can go to straight condo, and then once again, we're in a place where we have absolutely no ability to control it. It was interesting to me to see this as this instead of as a site plan, because what happens is we get these as site plans, and we have no choice but to go ahead and say, well, yeah, you can convert it, do whatever you want to do because of what the mayor talked about. I need to understand that, and you know what the possibilities are there. I guess the other piece of this is, in terms of market, we don't control the market. We aren't responsible for determining, as far as I can tell, whether or not somebody could possibly be successful in the market or not. But I do know that there have been a lot of things in this city that have been rezoned that have never moved forward with the new zoning on them. So potentially, these folks could get the zoning on this, they could get all these approvals, and they could sit around and wait for 4 or 5 years until the market shifted before they did anything with this. Isn't that true?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'd like that information on the impact of not having it go PAD, and what we would then be, what the pros and cons would be. And I don't know if there are any pros and cons to the city, whether or not it goes to a condo or whether it goes townhome.
Not sure there would be any.
Okay, well, you might want to think about that for a couple of days. Thank you, John.
Okay, Tom?
I don't quite understand what would be the problem if somebody waited 4 or 5 years if they got the rezone. There isn't?
No.
Okay. I just wasn't making the connection.
Mm-mm.
Okay. And I don't understand Scott's point either. I didn't know the city was supposed to get things for their regulatory approval, so if I'd have known that, I might have been a rich man for during the 4 years that I was on this council.
Scott?
Not so much the city as the residents. An upgrade of building code, upgrade fire code, and public safety issues. I think we improve their own public safety by that. I didn't mean to say the city has to get anything, but perhaps I should have said the residents. And I hope there wasn't a misunderstanding as far as the market. I wasn't saying we should control the market. Definitely not. We can't. As much as everybody I think wish we could, we can't control the market. The comment was, I'm just surprised hearing about the housing market and what happened in Scottsdale that this case came forward. It surprises me a little bit. That's all.
All right, we're on page 11. Rex?
Just a adjunct to that. You know, the market is a very powerful force, and people changing to townhomes. In my area, I can't talk about, we've never had problems with home ownership versus bad landlords of large apartments. Putting it in home ownership has usually been a solution to the problem. If they don't upgrade these, they don't make them nice, they won't sell. Okay, they need to move these to be the highest, best value, or they won't move. So that's the great thing about the market. It will determine whether this will be successful or not. I believe in putting in home ownership and private, especially owning the land underneath it as a townhome versus a condominium where you just have a lease on the property. This may make it move. It's also right behind our police station. It wraps around our entire police station. So we haven't had a lot of crime there. We'll wait and see whether that all of a sudden starts with home ownership, but I'd be in favor of it unless I hear something different.
Okay, we're on page 11. Let's go to page 12. Scott.
My data caused trouble up here, I'm sorry. On the last item.
Go back and study for another PhD. You've had
time. You guys will never stop hearing from me. Item 11, I just thought it'd be nice if we would discuss the unfortunate use of the word here, perhaps write off this. I was looking for Dave in the audience, and I don't see him, so maybe Jenny? Oh, maybe Jenny. It says here, write off utility and miscellaneous accounts for 3-month period. This is just an accounting issue. We're still going after the folks who owe money because it's $336,000.
That's right, Councilmember Summers. We turn this, after 120 days, we turn this over to a collection agency.
And that keeps our book, keeps our books moving forward in the right direction, and then these folks will have the collection folks go after them. Right?
That's correct.
So write-off doesn't mean forgetting about it.
Absolutely.
It just means changing the way we're seeking, pursuing the payment for services rendered.
How effective is the collection agency? Have you gone back and looked after a period of a year? Or
yes, we have an accounting of what they turn over to us and what we collect back. I think in your report it shows that we collected $50,000 this past quarter.
Okay, all right. Thanks. Rex.
Just to put this in perspective, what are our utility sales per year? $250 million, $220 million?
Let me look. Do you know off?
As a
this write-off is
I meant a year's sales of all our utility department, I remember, was over $200 million.
Yes, and the for this quarter the utility revenue was over $66 million for the quarter. So
if you're
we wrote off $225,000 of utility accounts, and the revenue was $66 million.
And we'll collect 30-40% of it or whatever later on. So it's a very, very, you know, the number looks huge if you're trying to balance your home budget, but as a looking at a corporate sheet of 200 and some million, it's a pretty small amount.
Historically, it's been less than half of 1%.
Yeah. This is 0.3%.
Yes.
For this quarter.
It's very good in the industry. We have a very good return.
Any industry would look very favorably on that kind of collection ratio. So thank you.
Yes.
Vice Mayor.
You know, I've been looking at these agendas for 8 years, and I think that the very first question I asked was why we were writing off the utilities. And what, you know, I think every council member who comes on, that's one of the first questions that they ask. And I imagine somewhere along the line I must have asked this question before, but I don't remember asking it. And that is, why do we write it this way on the agenda?
Yes.
Because every time it comes up, you know, we get articles about it. I've read people writing blogs about it. Why are we letting people off the hook? And I'm just wondering if there's a different way of writing this rather than saying approve write-off of utility and miscellaneous accounts, if there's a way of phrasing this that doesn't give the implication that somehow we're abandoning it. By now, I think most of us up here, if not all of us up here, know that we aren't abandoning it. We're still going after it, regardless of whether it's 0.3% or 0.1% or whatever it is. Yeah. Is there another way of doing it, Chris?
We'll look, Mayor Vice, we'll look at another term. The problem is that we have to go to the auditors and show which portion has been taken off our receivables account and transferred out. Otherwise, our books will carry this as an overstatement of receivables. And when you don't do that, you're not keeping your books clean. So what there may be, it's there may be a different terminology we can try to get, but at the end of the day, we are taking it off our books.
I completely agree.
I'm
married to an accountant.
We have to put a terminology in here that the CPAs, our outside auditors, go with, because we have to show them this document to say, this is what the council authorized. So if we can find another term that they're comfortable with, we'll be glad to do that.
Well, and you know, my husband's a CPA. I'm married to an accountant. I understand a lot of these accounting things. I'm talking about how it's written on this front sheet agenda. You could even have the backup that says writing off, because what people look at the front sheet and they just catch that. If they actually looked at the backup, it talks about collections and
what the terminology will be then is that this is the amount that will be turned over to a collection agency for this purpose. We can work on that.
Something like that.
With appropriate accounting.
Yeah, yes. Absolutely. You know what, Tom, that works.
Okay.
You know.
Thank you.
generally accepting accounted practices, we will do the following things and turn it over to a collection. Okay. Thank you.
Did I know the lint block?
Yes. Oh, I know.
It just looked bad.
I know.
Okay, anything else on page 12? If you remember way back on item number 11, it used to be the chair of the finance committee had to make the motion for the write-off.
Is that now, right?
Back in about 84, it's like, eh.
Well, I'm glad it isn't that way now, Mayor.
Yeah. All right. Let's go back to our agenda items then. Number two is hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on group homes.
Members. We're here today because there have been several questions that have been asked recently about group homes. City staff has organized as a team, taking kind of an interdisciplinary approach to take a look at this. And what you see before you is pretty much what we've developed as our best recommendation given the current circumstances that we're with. What we thought we would do is just kind of give a real brief, very, very brief history on how we kind of got here and then kind of take you through some options that we've developed to try to work through this issue a little bit. One of the things that I wanted to take into account is that although Debbie and I are up here presenting this, this is not just the city attorney's office and the planning department. The look into this particular issue has been, as I said, interdisciplinary. We've taken a look at this both from the building inspection standpoint, we've taken a look at this from the fire inspection standpoint, we've taken a look at this from the tax and licensing aspects of this. The police department has been involved in various aspects of this as well. This is not just the two of us up here. We have other people that you can ask questions of later on as we get through this presentation. The first thing to talk about really is kind of why we're here, and primarily that's because of some federal legislation that was passed in 1988 called the Federal Fair Housing Act. Up before you is the definition that comes out of that particular action of the federal government. Basically, it talks about what the definition of a handicap is. It's a physical or mental impairment which substantially limits one or more of such person's major life activities, a record of having such an impairment, or being regarded as having such an impairment. But such term does not include current illegal use or addiction to a controlled substance. Now, it kind of goes on further a little bit, and it says the term mental or physical impairment may include alcoholism, drug addiction, and the term major life activity may include performing manual tasks, caring for oneself, learning, speaking, or working. The reason that's important is because as part of the Federal Fair Housing Act and later and also as part of the American with Disabilities Act, the combination of those two require cities to open up their housing allowances or their housing areas to folks who have handicaps. And in particular, they are required, even in their zoning districts, to allow group homes into single residence districts. Now, that's a little bit unusual because if without that handicapped exception, zoning ordinance generally would exclude group homes in single residence districts. So there's an exception made for individuals who are handicapped so they can take advantage of some of the benefits that are perceived to come from living in single residence districts as opposed to living in an apartment district or a townhouse district or some other type of group home situation. So we're mandated to require that particular option. MESA does that. It does that, and this is a zoning ordinance definition that I have up in front of you now. Paralleling the federal act, very similar. Again, it's a handicapped individual is a person who has physical or mental impairment which substantially limits one or more of such person's major life activities, has a record of having such an impairment, or is regarded as having such an impairment. However, handicap shall not include, again, current illegal use or addiction to a controlled substance. And it defines where that comes from. Going further, in addition to defining handicap, the zoning ordinance and also the Mesa City Code regarding licensing defines what a group home for the handicapped is. And it's a dwelling that's shared as their residence by handicapped persons who reside together as a single housekeeping unit. So that's how it's allowed in a single residence district. It's one housekeeping unit in which staff persons may provide supervision, counseling, treatment, or therapy for residents therein, and which is not licensed by an agency of the state or federal government. The term shall include adult care homes, homes for the chronically medically ill, group care agencies, similar residential living arrangements for handicapped persons. Shall not include boarding houses, homes for the developmentally disabled, nursing homes, substance abuse treatment facilities, or any facility providing treatment or therapy to patients who do not reside on the premises. So it's not an outpatient center. It's not a developmentally disabled home. There's a special exception in state law for those. It's not a nursing home. It's not a substance abuse treatment facility. If you're currently using, you can't get this exception. In addition to that, there's something that the zoning ordinance calls a supervised living facility. This is a specialized group homes, but it's not for handicapped individuals. Currently, we do not have any supervised living facilities in Mesa. There's a provision that allows for them, but we currently don't have any approved sites. A supervised living facility is a residential facility which provides supervision or regulation of behavior, living conditions, or monitoring of the times residents leave, return, or absence from the facility for persons on probation, parole, pretrial release, or pursuant to the terms of a conditional release, or pre-release from a jail, prison, or correctional facility. The facility may also provide on-site or off-site supportive services. The term shall include boarding houses, dormitory apartments, other things, promoted, advertised, or operated as a supervised living facility. Shall not include a group home for the handicapped. So a group home for the handicapped cannot be a supervised living facility. It's still a group home. It's a different class of group home, specifically set aside for people who are coming out of prison or somehow are in the court system for some reason. Mesa also requires a license, and this is where we are going to ask you for some changes. We require a license for a supervised living facility. The supervised living facility definition is a little bit different than the zoning ordinance definition. I bolded that out on the presentation. It says it shall not include group homes for the handicapped, recovery homes. It's the only time recovery homes are actually mentioned, and facilities subject to the transit occupancy tax. The current zoning requirements for group homes for the handicapped, they're permitted in single residence districts, they're permitted in multiple residence districts. If they have more than 5 rooms with more than 10 residents, they require a special use permit. They're permitted in the town center districts in the TCR1, TCR2, TCR3. There, in addition to the zoning districts, there's also a locational criteria. There can have no more than 10 residents per home. There's no identification of the home from the street. They can't put up a sign that says Happy Acres Adult Living. They can compliance with all building and fire regulations. They have to be separated 1,200 feet from one another. They can't be right next door to one another. They are required to be in compliance with all licensing requirements. That would be state or city requirements. They have to register with the planning division, and the residents cannot pose a direct threat to others or to property. The supervised living facility requirements are currently under the current zoning code are considered as social service facility, and they're subject to the social service facility guidelines. Because of that, they're required to be located in an R4 district. They're also required to get a council use permit. There are no spacing requirements. So in theory, these could be located right on top of one another. Again, there are no supervised living facilities that are in Mesa. We've come to you today after taking a look at these and taking a look at several other cities' regulations. And our recommendations to you are that we bring Mesa closer in line with the regulations that we find in other Arizona communities, including the city of Phoenix and a few other of our neighbors. One of the things that we're asking you to do is to add recovery homes to the list of items that are not group homes for the handicapped. What that in essence would do is say that folks who are coming out of prison, for example, and may have a past alcohol addiction but may not necessarily be handicapped, could not use a recovery home as a means for transitioning back into society. In addition to that, it would say that if a person's, for example, trying to transition into society some other way without a handicap, they could not use a recovery home. So they would have to be they would have to transition to society through another means. We're proposing no other changes to the actual zoning requirements in terms of locational requirements, those types of things. Those would remain the same. We're asking that you delete the current requirements for supervised living facilities and delete the licensing requirements for group homes for the handicapped and supervised living facilities. And with that, the deletion of those particular licensing requirements, we would ask for a delay of, say, 2 to 3 months while we develop new enforcement tools to actually to go through and enforce some of these new efforts. In its place for supervised living facilities, we are asking you to adopt zoning regulations related to what we're referring to as the Phoenix model. After we drop the supervised living facility requirement, we are asking to add a new definition to the zoning ordinance for something called a correctional transitional housing facility. This would put us closer in line to what Phoenix has. Correctional transitional housing facility, or a CTHF, is a supervised residential center where individuals who are completing a sentence reside for a defined period of time for counseling, job placement assessment, and similar services that assist in transitioning from institutional to community living. But now the item that I have in bold, and I don't think I bolded it on yours, but the term shall include any boarding house, dormitory, or apartment building or other dwelling when developed, promoted, advertised, or operated as a correctional transitional housing facility, which now shall not include group homes for the handicapped or any facility providing counseling or other services to individuals who do not reside on the premises. We're actually adding that to the Phoenix definition. We feel that gives a little bit more clarity to the folks on our end who are trying to interpret this. In addition to adding that definition, we're asking that we take a look at some of the zoning districts these would permit, where these would be permitted. Rather than allowing these in the R4 district with a council use permit, we're asking that we would place these in C3, M1, and M2 zones. So this would be general commercial, light industrial, and general industrial districts. We would still require the approval of a council use permit, so they would still come through planning and zoning, and then eventually the decision for their location would be approved by the city council. There would be a spacing requirement for these. There would be 1 mile between light correctional transitional housing facilities, so you would not, again, get one on top of another. They wouldn't be a congregation of these in any one particular spot. They would be 500 feet from any residential district or from a school. Continued compliance with fire and building regulations. We're asking that you limit these to 30 beds. Parenthetically, Phoenix allows up to 50 beds in these types of facilities. And we would ask you to continue the requirement that they cannot house people who are a direct threat to the health and safety of others. We have a few other discussional topics if you'd like to go that way. Regarding fire inspections, currently we do require fire inspections for group homes. We do that through the city license and through state licenses. Phoenix and other cities do not currently do fire inspections for group homes. In talking with the fire inspection staff, they feel that that's a good idea to continue that, and so we'd like to pursue ways to figure out a way to continue to require those inspection requirements. There's what we refer to as the Pine Top model. Pine Top has gone to an annual certification requirement that they get through their general business license. And so right now we have a one-time registration when it comes to the planning department. They register their particular site, we put it up on a map. We don't currently follow that up on an annual basis to determine whether or not they're still active at that particular site. So there may be, for example, registrations that date back to 1995 or 1996, and we currently don't know if they're still operating at that location. So we need to do some follow-up work on our end on that, but We would like to have that become part of a requirement, and maybe ask you if you think that's a good idea. In addition to that, some of these changes to the zoning code, anytime you make changes to the zoning code, when you take away a permitted use from a particular activity, you get into grandfathering issues or creating legal nonconforming uses. And so we're going to continue to look at ways on how grandfathering options or grandfathering issues will affect this particular item. But currently right now we're asking for direction to start making these changes. We would start with the zoning changes by taking them to the Planning and Zoning Board, possibly in the October meeting, and likely would come back to you for decision on after their recommendation in November. Just real quick, and to show you about the possible locations about the correctional transitional housing facilities. There are a couple of maps that I passed out to you. This is a citywide map. This is a real quick analysis. All this does is show sites that are zoned C3, M1, or M2 and are 500 feet away from a residential district. This does not show sites that would be 500 feet away from a school. That kind of creates too much of a wild card for a quick analysis like this is. But this would kind of show you real quick where those eligible locations are. Taking a look at it on a little bit more detailed basis, we took a look at the Broadway Corridor and the Falcon Field area. This would be the Falcon or the Broadway Corridor area. The items that are in yellow are highlighted. Those are the eligible locations. We're talking about creating the separations from on a parcel-to-parcel basis. And so what you're looking at are eligible parcels. And then this real quickly would be eligible sites in the Falcon Field area. And again, this is strictly looking at nothing but zoning and the 500-foot separation. So with that, any questions that you might have?
Okay. Let's open it up for questions, Vice Mayor.
Thank you. First of all, there are a whole bunch of people that I want to thank for working on this. And this is an effort. Gordon, I don't know how long we've been working on this, but it's a while. So huge thanks to you. Also, Scott Butler, Debbie Spinner, Rod, Keisha. We got people in a room one day. We had a whiteboard going. Tom, that whiteboard thing works really well. We had definitions up there, and we were trying to analyze everything. And one of the things that became very clear, frankly, thanks to Chief Gascon, who he and I ended up in a meeting together, and he was saying one thing, and I'm sitting there thinking, wait, that isn't right. And it turned out that a lot of the problem that we were having was definitions. We would throw out the term halfway house, and we used it across the board to mean everything, and it became a real problem. The police department's working hard with us on this, and I really appreciate it. This has not been an easy process. Councilmember Claude Maddox from Phoenix also helped me. I heard that somebody contacted me and said, Phoenix is doing something different. Well, I contacted Claude. I went through. I asked him what they were doing, and it sounded like exactly what we were doing, except that he said, oh, wait, we just passed something new. And that was that's the one that you're referring to as the Correctional Transitional Housing Facility, CTHF. And so that's when I came back and asked for us to look at that. And it also brought to light an issue that we had in terms of definitions within our code versus their code. So thank you. I know that this has just been a ton of work. I have a couple of questions. First of all, I want to clarify something, because my understanding, I still have some issues that have nothing to do with the city of Mesa or what we're doing with the code. So Debbie, my understanding of the federal law is that in federal law, someone's handicap status takes precedence over their criminal status. Is that correct? Is that your understanding?
I'm not sure if we say it takes precedent over an individual. If they are handicapped and they meet the legal definition in the Federal Fair Housing Act, they meet the legal definition of handicap, they are entitled to protection under the Federal Fair Housing Act, and they are entitled to go into a group home for the handicapped.
And that takes precedence over other things that we might put into place, and that's
right.
What I'm talking about.
Right.
Because we get contacted by people who say, you know, I have these people who are living across the street from me, and I tell them it's federal law, and people don't like that answer. They would like to believe that we can fix anything. I'd like to believe we could fix anything, but that one I'm still working on with our federal people, because I have a problem with that. I really do. I think that there are some issues in terms of what should take precedence over what. So I'm still working on that one. I think that this is moving us
I think that we need to go to these definitions. I think it's the right way to go. I think that this is just, we've got a few more steps that we have to go through to get there entirely. And I still think that it's a positive for us to know who's operating in our community and what they're doing. And the other thing that I have a problem with is that the state, I believe, should have some sort of licensing requirement for people who operate recovery facilities, so that you can't just hang out your shingle and say, come live in this place and recover from whatever it is. And people are making, there are good operators out there. We need good operators. We have people who suffer terribly from these addictions, and it's a blight for their lives. It's a blight on society, and we need those good operators. But the bad operators hurt everybody. And so I really believe that the state needs to get in the business of you know, not just washing their hands of that. They need to be paying attention to that. That is not a City of Mesa issue. That's a statewide issue. And so I expect that we will continue to work on that. But I think that this is taking us in the right direction. So thanks again for all the work.
Okay. Kyle.
I do want to express appreciation to all those who have worked on this. It's been a challenge from the time I started on council to address these. And specifically, there's an awful lot in my area. And I appreciate all the work that's been done. And usually the biggest challenge we've had is, okay, the Federal Fair Housing Act, American Disabilities, that's their trump on us. They always use it. But in reading now, you've got this in front of us, the current illegal use of an addictive substance. So if somebody's claiming they're an alcoholic staying in a facility, if they use alcohol, then they just kick themselves out of the home. Is that technically correct?
Yes.
Councilmember Jones, that's technically correct. If you are currently using an illegal substance or even alcohol, you do not meet the legal definition of handicapped. What is left undefined is how long do you have to be not using to be entitled to the protection?
And since that's not defined federally, can we define it locally?
Let's see that one.
We could try. What I can tell you, what we've tried to do with adult probation, for example, we have raised the issue with adult probation. Gordon and I went over and met with them, and we discussed this, and they do some recovery homes do testing, and some is required according to their probation, and they are not necessarily removed from the home if they come up with a test that shows that they are currently using. We've asked that some action be taken so that they be removed from the home, or at least they are now ineligible to reside in a group home for the handicapped. So we are trying to open up the lines of communication so that if adult probation comes with the becomes aware of the fact that a resident in a group home for the handicapped is currently using alcohol or drugs, that we be made aware of that, and we may be able to take action to remove that specific individual from the home.
Because we do have those who are legitimately trying to get out of that rut, and for those I have no problem, but it's the ones who hide behind the facade and use that as a crutch to live where they are, and it is no secret, the police have the data to back it up, that a lot of crime coincides around many of these homes, and we are trying to address the situation. So I would like to take a good look at that and make sure, and I appreciate your checking into that already, but still, We need to get the message out there that we have to make sure that those who are legitimately disabled are treated appropriately, but those who are hiding behind it, hiding behind the law, we need to make sure we address that. But we've come a long ways, and as Claudia mentioned, the terminology, so that we all get on the same page. And once we get everything defined, make sure all the employees know what we're talking about so we don't have the confusion.
Okay. Mike and Tom?
I have a little trouble with us trying to enforce whether someone is sober today or not today when we can't enforce the laws that we've currently got with the amount of manpower that we have. So I think that's the wrong direction to go. The recovery community knows that sometimes it takes a year, 2 years, 3 years to fully recover, and then it's only a day at a time after that. So you've always got the possibility of somebody falling off the wagon and going back. It's a curse of our society, and it's not just alcohol, it's drugs, it's everything else. part of the problem that we face in Mesa is we have low-income property. We have cheap housing, and that's why we attract group homes. That's why we have this problem. And until we raise the standard of our housing, that's going to continue. You know, there's a local merchant downtown who runs group homes. And that person told me a year or two ago when we were looking at doing a redevelopment down there that if price gets high enough, I'll move. And, you know, so that's our problem is to try to get redevelopment done so that we can change these things. I like the idea of a annual license to make sure that we have some control of who is operating where. And they are a business. People do make money from the operation of both recovery homes, group handicap homes, and what's the other one you were talking about, supervised living homes. It's no different than Mr. Jones having a business or the mayor or anyone else. I think they should be business licensed. The problem we have in Mesa is that we only license one time. We don't annually renew our licenses, so we don't have any idea if they're not paying taxes, who's still there and who's still not. I do business in 13 Valley cities. I pay an annual renewal in every one of the cities that I do business in. I'm further regulated in the alarm industry that I'm in, that I have to do a background check and fingerprint checks and all those other things. And, you know, I'm a bad guy, but I don't think I'm that bad. When you've got other businesses that deal with much more dangerous subjects, they don't have to relicense at all. So I think that's something that we need to look at, is to take that burden. And I agree with you, Claudia. I think the state should be the one doing this. But, you know, we've said, well, the federal government will work on immigration. How well is that going? You know, we said the state will help us on this. I think states should regulate the industry I'm in also, rather than make each individual city do it. But we need to start somewhere, because we're the group home haven of the valley. Why do we think we have more? Because we count them. Other cities don't. You know, I've heard the rumor that people call Scottsdale and say, can I open a group home? And Scottsdale says, no, go to Mesa. Well, that's not necessarily true. Scottsdale doesn't count. They use the Phoenix model. People just show up. I got a call this week in my neighborhood, a 7-bedroom house, a young couple moved in, 2 people, and now there are people starting to show up at this 7-bedroom house. We have no way of regulating that. We have no way of knowing who is staying there. Are they charging rent? Is it a group home? Whatever the case may be. So I think we need to do something, and I think the business license is the way to go. But that also means that I think we should relicense every business in Mesa with a nominal fee so that we know who's here and who's not here. And I think it would help us in the long run, and I'll probably get calls on this one.
Tom?
Well, I'll be first. I don't like that idea. But more importantly, I'm a little troubled by the direction of one part of the conversation that I've heard, which is that if somebody is addicted to alcohol and has a drink, they're somehow no longer handicapped. Because I don't believe that alcohol is a controlled substance under the federal code. And your definition of what isn't handicapped does not include current illegal use or addiction to a controlled substance, as defined by Section 102 of the Controlled Substance Act. I don't believe alcohol is a controlled substance. So if we're even beginning to think about having people kicked out of a home because they take a drink, we better reconsider.
And Councilmember Rawls, Mayor, I apologize if I misspoke. If they are in a recovery home and they are considered handicapped because of their alcohol addiction, then if they are currently using the substance, I believe they would no longer fall within the legal definition of being handicapped.
And do you have some language other than what you put here in front of me that would suggest that? Because our definition of handicap says it does not include people who are addicted to or using controlled substances, and alcohol is not a controlled substance under the federal code.
I can go back and check that. I don't have it with me, okay, Councilmember.
You see
Rawls.
What I'm saying? If,
I do.
If we're going to start saying alcohol, we're going to treat alcohol like we do heroin. I don't think that's the intent of the Federal Controlled Substance Act. I've read that in my day, and I don't remember references to alcohol. So I think we better be very careful before we start running out trying to kick people out of group homes because they drink, even if that's the basis of their handicap.
I will check and confirm that, Councilmember Rawls. Obviously, this is going to be an ongoing process that we'll bring back to council many times.
And I don't really like the idea of the city. I think that there's got to be some self-regulation here, and maybe it comes in the licensing, but you know, are we going to have the probation department and the police department and the parole department from the Department of Corrections, everybody's going to report to us when somebody who is in a handicapped home or GH, H, whatever it is, F, has a dirty urine test, and then we're going to somehow go out and request that group home owner to have that person removed from the facility? Is that what we're advocating? Because that's what it sounded like.
And Mayor, Councilmember Rawls, we haven't come close to that point yet. What we've been asked to do is go back and look, how do we ensure that homes that are labeled and treated as group homes for the handicapped, how do we determine and enforce that these are truly handicapped individuals that are living in these homes as opposed to non-handicapped individuals? And handicapped has, as we talked about, a specific definition. So how do we regulate the group homes for the handicapped to ensure that the residents living in these homes are truly handicapped under the federal law?
Well, I'm not sure, and it's one of the reasons I think we're getting involved in things we shouldn't even get involved in, but I just have no, I agree with Mike on this part of it, and that is I don't understand how in the world we would expect to have the manpower and the resources to enforce any of these kinds of day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month status of people who have addictions. You know, if somebody is developmentally disabled, okay, that's not something that changes day-to-day for the most part. Or if they have a psychosis, or if they have a whatever it is, if they're in a wheelchair bound, but those are fairly clear. But if you're going to start trying to on a daily basis regulate the people in these homes because they have somehow fallen off the wagon one day, had one dirty urine test, and by the way, a dirty urine test doesn't necessarily conclusively establish anything. You got all sorts of arguments that you can make about whether the test was valid and how it was performed and all this stuff. I mean, it's just a can of worms. I mean, I don't have any problem with the changes that you're proposing to sort of clean up the code, get rid of the licensing requirements, because it probably wasn't something we really want to do anyway, and on for some of the things that we've talked about. But to go beyond that and set up a super police force to monitor the people in these group homes, I just can't imagine us wanting to do it or being effective at it at all.
And Councilmember Rawls, I would agree. And there was never any contemplation that this would be something the staff would actually enforce. What we intend to do is place the burden on the operator. If the operator is avowing to us that they're operating a group home for the handicapped, they need to avow that the individuals and the residents living in those homes meet the legal definition of handicap. But this is certainly an issue that we can talk to council about, and these regulations or these requirements can be discussed and modified.
I appreciate that, but even if you put the burden on the owner, he has to avow what, hourly, that nobody in his group home has fallen off the wagon? Oops, sorry. This person's no longer, you know, contact the city of Mesa, because I have 19 people in my home, and or my two homes. I can have a limit of 10 here, apparently. So I have 10 people in my home, and 9 of them are clean this morning, but one of them isn't. So, I mean, what kind of burden is that? It makes no sense to me.
Okay, Kyle?
It's a burden of being a responsible operator, and thank you, Debbie, for clarifying. The burden does go on the operators, that they will attest that those that they are housing are clearly handicapped or qualify under that qualification. No, we don't have the means to go out and do enforcement. We don't have the means to do a whole lot of checking. But if it becomes apparent in the course of crimes being committed, officers pick up somebody, find out that's where he lives, and it's obvious that he's impaired for drug use, and alcohol was probably not the best example, but more of the drug use. People, if they're continuing using and hiding behind that facade, that's what we need to address. We're not making some super deal. There's people who are going to fall off the wagon. There's no doubt addictions are hard to break, no doubt whatsoever. But those individuals who continuously fall off the wagon repeatedly, don't need to be living in those neighborhoods. They need to be in the places that are in the other designated areas for their recovery. And that's what we're trying to address.
Okay, Rex?
You know, any regulation is going to be problematic. I think this moves us forward to where we need to be. Right now, I get calls and, you know, how does Mesa allow a sex offender home next to a girls' school? And why can't you zone it? And we can't. They hide behind fair housing, ADA, whatever it is. We're not saying you can't do it. You need a transition facility from prison to the regular society, et cetera. But there's no reason that cannot be in an industrial area rather than next to a neighborhood or a school or whatever it is. That's all we're saying, that good operators can go and build a bigger facility and actually do a better job and hire skilled counselors with 30 beds in an industrial area than seven in next to your home where they, quote, are a counselor and they're just really a moneymaker. So this moves it towards where we need to be. It puts it in areas that are less conflicting. If I was doing a group recovery home for alcoholics, I wouldn't necessarily build it next to a bar. Some of these are right next to them. They're just money-making flop houses. They're not really what they're disguised to be. And there is no counseling going on. There is no help for people. There is no transition helping people get a job and move into society. So I think this will help separate some of the good operators from the bad operators and be good for Mesa long term. Will there be problems as we move along this road? Probably. We're going to need to redefine it. We're going to need to protect people's rights. And we're going to need to move ahead and become a modern city. I think this is a good step towards it. And if anybody wants to disagree with us, they're going to have to take on our legal department and Phoenix's, which is going to be a little more challenging. So thank you.
Scott?
Debbie, a legal question, please.
Federal law, specifically the Americans with Disabilities Act, requires employers, including cities, to provide reasonable accommodation to folks that have disability. Someone in a wheelchair, it might mean placing your office on the ground floor, having ramps installed so they have access elevators for multi-story. What is the reasonable accommodation for somebody with an alcohol addiction?
Councilmember Summers, I'm not sure I can answer that because I think it would depend on what the individual's needs are. You know, typically the way these reasonable accommodations are addressed are by the individual coming forward and saying, here's what the rule or the law is. I need a reasonable accommodation. Can you do X for me? And so it's more on one-on-one basis. So if you give me a specific example, I may be able to help you, but I'm not sure I can with a general question.
I think we can stay general. Is alcohol addiction and drug addiction, specifically alcohol addiction, covered under the Americans with Disabilities Act for employers?
I believe it is if it meets one of the three definitions there. If the alcoholism results in a physical or mental impairment which substantially limits one or more of the person's major life activities, or a record, if the person has a record of having such an impairment or being regarded as having such an impairment. So, yes, alcoholism can fall within the ADA if the individual, and the Federal Fair Housing Act, if the individual satisfies one of those three criteria.
Well, yank the rug out from under me. It was my understanding the ADA didn't cover drug or alcohol abuse, and I was curious as to why, if it wasn't covered in the employment sector, why it was suddenly we were able to use it for housing. But this is interesting, something I'd like to look into more.
Okay, and let me back up a little bit, make sure we're separating the two, the Federal Fair Housing Act from the American with Disabilities Act.
Yeah.
I haven't specifically looked at the ADA. I have looked at the Federal Fair Housing Act. The Federal Fair Housing Act does say that an individual who is addicted to alcohol can be considered handicapped under that act, and if they are entitled or if they are defined as handicapped, they meet the definition, they're eligible for protections under the Federal Fair Housing Act.
Right.
I guess
two
I would
federal
wanna,
laws, and I understand right. that they're different. ADA may not protect an employee,
but yet the Federal Fair Housing Act is requiring us to put them into housing. So I'm just pointing out this glaring difference. As you have employees who aren't protected, and yet we're able to take folks out of the prison system who may have an alcohol abuse, and they're all of a sudden covered by a different law. Inconsistencies in federal law.
And going back to your original question about reasonable accommodations, a recovery home, for example, could still request a reasonable accommodation under the rules that we were to establish if we adopt the Phoenix model, for example. And even currently, we have a 1,200-foot separation requirement. They could come in and ask for a reasonable accommodation that we reduce that 1,200-foot limit. And then we would analyze that on a case-by-case basis and what else is going on in the area to determine whether that's a reasonable accommodation or not.
Yeah. How about that for adding some complexity to this?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you.
Tom?
Let me try to make sure that nobody's perceiving. I think we're starting to mix two things together here, and I think it's important to separate them. We're talking about creating a new zoning classification called Correctional Transitional Housing Facilities that are going to be limited to C3, M1, and M2. Take them out of the neighborhoods. Take them out of the residential. I'm all in favor of that. That was not what I was talking about, so that's over here. The person who comes out of prison, the person who is on probation, the person who has some portion of his term of servitude to the state as a result of criminal conduct, it goes into the CTHF. Okay. The people with disabilities or handicaps who are looking for a place to live, not even necessarily transitional, but a place to live in group homes, is what I was talking about earlier, where I don't want to get into the everyday policing of those, the eligibility of every resident in every one of those homes on a daily basis. I understand what Kyle said in terms of we want the owners to be responsible, and they should be to a certain extent, but it's not something that I think we can effectively do on a micro basis, and that was all I was saying. And I'm also concerned about the alcohol, but I've already made that point. So that's Rex, I think we were mixing apples and oranges a little bit, and I want to make sure that people knew where my primary concern was. I think that people who are in the transitional facilities are going to have a whole one set of standards, and the people who are in the group home for the handicapped have another.
All right. Claudia, and then let me see if I can wrap this up.
Okay, thank you. I think the problem we have is that the line isn't quite so clear. And that's where we get into difficulties, and I think that's where the police get into difficulties, and that is when one is masking as the other. If you say to somebody who's coming out of jail, just tell people that you're addicted to alcohol, and then we can put you in this treatment home over here, and the guy says, well, I've never had a drink in my life, I don't drink. Well, tell them you're addicted to drugs. Well, I've never used drugs. Yeah, well, just say it. As long as you say it, you can go in this group, in this facility over here. And you may still have a part of your term that you need to finish. You have that that obligation, Tom, that you talked about to the state, and I think that's where it gets really murky. And we have, and that's why we're continuing to look at some things, not for an everyday application of the law, but for when somebody is apparently trying to hide behind Americans with Disabilities and Fair Housing Acts, masking what they're really doing, which is having a transitional living facility for people who are coming out of prison to get back into mainstream society. And that's where I think we have more problems than anything else. So I agree with what you're saying. I just think that the lines are very blurred. I was concerned about one thing that Mike said. I want to follow up on it. He said we don't have any, and maybe I misunderstood it, but that we didn't have the right to go out and we had no way of dealing with that situation that he was talking about in his neighborhood. I'm thinking under the existing code that you can't just open a business, what amounts to a business, in a residential neighborhood by opening a boarding house. So I think we have the right to send code officers to go and find out, have you opened a boarding house? Are you renting rooms? Are you, where are we on that, Debbie?
Let me ask Gordon or Ray on how, on a day-to-day basis, how they operate or
you
how they
knock on the door.
To the request.
Ray might be able to answer the question about the enforcement aspect of this. In terms of the interpretation, if someone came to us and said, may I operate a 7-bedroom facility and I can open up and just rent out the bedrooms for that. The zoning ordinance already says that a boarding house is defined as anything where you rent out more than two bedrooms. When you divide, as soon as you start renting out a third bedroom and there's more than two people in each bedroom, then that becomes a boarding house under the current zoning ordinance definition. So seven bedrooms would obviously be considered a boarding house under the current classification.
Unless it's a group recovery home.
No, even if it's a group recovery home, it still wouldn't be allowed in single residence.
Unless they come in and they have registered with planning and under the current code gotten a license, correct? If they are applying for a group home for the handicapped.
Well, and then they would be limited to one person per bedroom.
Right.
And Vice Mayor, what we would do is if we get the complaint, we would go ahead and follow up to see what the whether it was a boarding house or whether they were registered with the planning to see if they were a group home for the handicapped. And if they weren't, and if they were operating that way, we would then follow up with that and as a zoning violation. Otherwise, if they were operating as a boarding house, and as long as they met the criteria for that, it would be allowable.
The other thing you would check is whether or not there was anything else within 1,200 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And so if those folks, you know, if Mike gave you the address, you guys didn't have it, you could look at that and see whether or not they fell in that classification as well. We do have some tools. I don't want people to think that there are no tools in place at all. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, let's see if we can go through this. On page 5, there's a summary of proposed changes. And I'm not, unless you have an idea on how to get the consensus here off the council, I think that I've not heard any objection to the correctional transitional housing facility change to model in similar to what Phoenix is doing. So I believe that the summary of proposed changes on page 5 and then on page 6 is okay. The additional discussion items, I think we'll have to come back on some of those, especially the annual certification, whether what type of licensing, how do you check to make sure that they're in compliance on an annual basis instead of a one-time basis, which was discussed. Is that the direction you need this morning, or are you looking for something else?
Yes, Mayor, we...
Does anybody object to that summary? Are we all right? Thank
you. One thing we didn't talk about was the fire inspections, and when I had met with you earlier, Gordon, I'd asked that perhaps the fire department look at more of an intermediate inspection for these type of homes and not hit them the same as they do with the hazardous or high-risk fees. If that could be looked into while you're doing the others.
Sure.
All right. Is there a subcommittee of the council that could kind of go through these additional discussion items? Because it also gets fairly complicated very quickly.
It does, Mayor. And if council wants to send this to a subcommittee, we'd be more than happy to work with the subcommittee.
Okay. What would be the appropriate one? Under police?
Under public safety.
Public safety? All right. Let's do that so that we can have some recommendations coming forward. I think it'll expedite the discussion. All right, anything else under this item? All right.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. Let's go on to number 3 here, presentation on the 2007 Arizona legislative session wrap-up. I would assume that with the late hour of the meeting last night, this would either be very brief or non-existent.
Yeah, and Mayor, I think you and I had discussed that maybe we would skip over that today and go to the resolutions, right. Discussion on next year's resolutions. And, of course, if there are any questions about the current legislation that passed this year, we do have the new laws report that the League of Cities and Towns puts out annually. And, of course, as I have done the last several months, I'll be glad to update you one-on-one on any questions you may have about that legislation.
Okay, let's move on to item number 4 then. That's a presentation, discuss and provide direction on the proposed Arizona League of Cities and Towns resolutions as recommended by the Intergovernmental Affairs Committee.
Great, thank you, Mayor. Next week, the League of Arizona Cities and Towns will convene. The resolutions committee will meet on Tuesday, and Vice Mayor Walters is the city's representative to the resolutions committee. What you have included in your packet, titled 2007 Resolution Subcommittee Recommendations, as you may remember, last year the League began a process of having a subcommittee of the resolutions committee come together to try to group and make some sense out of all the resolutions that are submitted. And actually, this year was one of the fewest submissions that the league has dealt with in a long time, because people see that there's some complexity and, frankly, I mean, Vice Mayor Walters may want to deal with this, but some difficulties with the resolutions process, and it's a very transitional process right now that we're looking at reforming and making some changes to next year. But that being said, the resolution subcommittee, and Vice Mayor Walters was also a member of the subcommittee, convened on August the 2nd to go through all the resolutions and to recommend to the full committee the recommendations to make. Included on your subcommittee recommendations sheet on the last column is the IGA committee recommendations. We did bring this to the Intergovernmental Affairs Committee last week, and the council subcommittee was able to evaluate this, and the recommendations are to whether to support or oppose the subcommittee recommendations. And so that's why you will see, for example, on section 2, where resolutions not recommended, the IGA committee recommendation was to support. That was to support the subcommittee recommendation to not recommend. So it's a little it's a little challenging, but we're trying to work with the system that that the league's given us on this. So and with that, Mayor, I should also explain as well that under this scenario, sections 1, sections 2, 3, and 4 are all for inclusion or not to include in the municipal policy statement that is distributed to the legislature each year. It was determined that sections 5, 6, and 7, best practices, a county agenda, and a federal agenda, is not necessarily for distribution to the legislature, because that doesn't really reflect our legislative priorities. That is for internal discussion and debate at the league about how to handle those issues. And I'd be glad to clarify those as well as we move forward. So Mayor, with that, certainly we could go through by section. And in section 1, these items were recommended for adoption on the consent agenda. The only resolution that the subcommittee and also the IGA committee had some concern with was resolution number 6. In some discussions with the City of Phoenix and others throughout the process, we're not sure if the resolution that they're trying to do, which is to allow on an RFQ situation for you to request a price point or to describe a price point, is allowed under statute. They're looking at that, but we've also heard from several groups that the way they're going about doing that, it may not be the right way, and just also the questions of procurement as to whether, if you do choose an RFQ and you're supposed to base it on qualifications, what role price should play. And be glad to explain that if there's any questions about it. But Mayor, out of the items on agenda 1, resolution number 6 is the only one that it's recommended that the Vice Mayor pull and discuss at the resolutions committee.
Okay. Questions on the recommendations? I have several comments. I've been on this before, but I think I'll, because I wasn't present, I'll just let them go.
Great. Well, then, Mayor, moving on to section 2, these are resolutions that were not recommended. As you'll see, though, several of them, if you'll notice the asterisks to the sides of their numbers, have been placed in different sections, whether it was decided they weren't recommended because it was best dealt with at a county level and didn't need legislative action, or if it's a federal item that didn't really need a. We're trying to move away from postcards to Congress as much as possible, because that just wastes the time of the legislature and doesn't really win us any friends down there. So that was the decision of the subcommittee to move away from those. But I'll be glad to answer any questions on Section 2.
Tom?
If I can jump back, I wasn't quite sure what we were doing. I know it's not going to make any difference, but on Section 1, Item 21, it looks innocuous as written in the summary, but when you look at the actual resolution 21 is talking about criminal offenses being issued by civilian employees. I don't like that. Making that, don't know how the rest of anybody else feels, but I don't like it. number 17 on number 2, I just wondered whether anybody had made an attempt on drafting a law that would require cooperation. Well, the language is just amazing here. Better spirit of cooperation. Are we going to pass a law? We're going to request the legislature to pass a law requiring, no, not requiring, I'm sorry, encouraging better spirit of cooperation between cities and towns and counties. This is the appropriate disposition of it, which is to ignore it.
Yeah. As is our recommendation.
That's all I have on number 2. Well, I can't support most of these in any form anyway, so just basically I'm just going to make hit and miss on certain ones that are particularly outrageous, but no. Collectively they're essentially an attempt to have local governments be entitled to spend more, regulate more, or control more, and I'm not in favor of any of those three. So.
Okay, that's why I showed up for 2 years and passed it on to Claudia. Vice Mayor.
Well, I appreciate your sharing the opportunity for frustration. The point I made to the Resolutions Committee was that I feel like our process is wrong, that what we should be doing rather than doing resolutions is saying, what are the two or three outcomes that we anticipate that would make it easier to operate as municipalities that we can take forward to the legislature this year? And I can understand if you are a small community and you don't have a Scott Butler, you don't have a Chris Brady, you don't have, in some instances, you know, you really don't have anybody that you're working with, and so they're looking to the League of Cities and Towns to assist them with their issues. I think the League should assist them with their issues, but this is how ridiculous it gets, Tom. We, in previous years, and I'm hoping it won't happen this year, I've asked them not to do it. They would then vote, if you take this list of resolutions, the ones, anything that gets adopted, they would vote on what the top five priorities were for the League of Cities and Towns. So let's assume that the initiative for mandating native plant standards, which we're all saying, mandating native plant standards? Excuse me. Let's assume that passed. And now we vote on, that would be one of the top five priorities for the League of Cities and Towns at the legislature this year. That's ridiculous. I said, let me just tell you, if transportation and accessibility and infrastructure are not the top, one of the top five, you've got a problem. And yet you might end up with the top five being something like maintaining the Heritage Fund level, mandating native plant standards, mandating that cities and counties get along well, which I made exactly the same comment you made about that one. What does that law look like? And getting a water, you know, getting new infrastructure in a small community in northern Arizona. Now, it is not that it isn't important for us to get, you know, for that city to have that, but for that to be the priority at the League just doesn't make sense. So we're trying to move in a different direction, and I know, Kino, I know you worked on this, and you know, I'm hopeful. Hope springs eternal. Thank you.
I was hopeful for 3 years.
Yeah.
Okay. And Mayor, too, and to that point as well, I know Boyd Dunn, who is the, well, current and also incoming president, it will continue his term as president of the League, has an idea to completely reform the resolutions process that's more in line with what the larger cities have been asking for several years, which is more of, as the Vice Mayor described it, policy statements, a policy agenda, and not necessarily specific item to go change this line in statute, as we've done our resolutions, but talking about big picture items, public safety, transportation, all neighborhood issues, those things that many of the larger cities have to deal with as well. So it's a frustration, though, as many of you know, that's the one committee where Jerome has the same vote as Phoenix or Springerville has the same vote as Mesa, and it's sometimes hard to make some change at the League through that process.
Well, I agree with the Vice Mayor. I think the sentiment ought to be, what's the big picture out there that advances the state? That's where we should be, and the rest of these are just kind of chaffed in the way. So if you want to hurry through the rest of this stuff, it's okay with me.
Great. Well, knowing that, Mayor, going on to items 3, those are the critical municipal issues, which is maybe a first attempt, as the Vice Mayor might describe it, at trying to get to some of those bigger picture issues. And especially item 13, we had Resolution 13, we had three separate resolutions that were very parochial in how they were requesting changes to transportation policy. And what the subcommittee recommended, and I've attached a revised, or I've laid a revised Resolution 13 on your desk, was to take a broad-based look at the transportation needs of the state, to talk about multimodal, to talk about commuter rail or other mechanisms and highway funding dollars, both urban and rural, to bring a transportation resolution forward that actually brings us together as cities and towns instead of dividing us between urban and rural or big and small. And so Resolution 13 that's on your desk is an attempt by the cities that submitted this resolution to revise that to make it more palatable for 90 cities and towns to support. So,
what action are we looking for here this morning?
Sure. Mayor, as you can see, the IGA recommendations are, if there's any disagreement with the recommendations of the IGA, the Council IGA Committee, we could discuss and entertain those, or if not, it would just be to confirm the recommendation of the IGA Committee.
Okay. Vice Mayor, you think you're the voting delegate. Do you have any questions for the council and which ones or anything?
Just if there's a majority of the council that wants me to do something differently. I actually have problems with number 21 as well, but I will tell you that they cited Mesa and our downtown parking enforcement as their right. as their model for this. So I think, we may talk about it a little bit. The reason that I didn't get all hot and bothered about it is because it's permissive language. It does not require a city to adopt this. It they're looking for permissive language in the state code. I don't see it as something we would want.
Okay. Other discussion on this, Tom?
I don't think we want to create that opportunity for any municipality to decide to have civilian employees writing criminal tickets. Number five, I think it's a bad idea. One about liquor. I also can't believe it's one of the priorities, or can't believe it's a critical issue. Increased municipal input. I personally wouldn't have the entire liquor control operation, but it's state controlled. We don't need to have the local 21, or I'm sorry, 19. I mean, commuter rail is a waste of money. But those are just specific ones along with what I've already identified that I specifically can't support.
Okay. Vice Mayor, how would you like to get the direction you need to represent the city?
If there are three other people who agree with Council Member Rawls on that, those, then I need to know. Or if there are four.
I certainly agree on the code
Years.
Enforcement. I don't think I think code enforcement takes it at a higher level, so I would oppose instead of being neutral. So.
I need to hear from, I guess.
Why don't you conduct this part and see if you can get consensus on those so you know what you need to do.
Okay, on 21, do we have a motion on 21? I guess that's what I'm really looking for, is a motion on 21. This is a neutral, the way this is written is neutral, but it would allow.
Permissible, even. I move we oppose.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, so the motion fails, and so we'll move ahead with allowing the neutral position on it. Are there any others that somebody wants to make a motion on that's contrary to the recommendation of the Intergovernmental Affairs Committee?
I'm sorry, are we going to pull item 6? I think we had talked about that.
Item 6.
For separate vote.
So we're the position is that we're opposing it. I will pull it off of the consent agenda.
Right.
And if you want to change that, then you need to make a motion.
What I was hoping would happen.
Okay.
Well, let me take one. Just if we're doing these votes, I take number 3. Continue small-time revenue appropriations. Four little cities come up and say, you know, we can't survive at our level, and I told them we'll just de-annex. Go back and be a county, and they said, no, we can't do that. We're, you know, Jerome and a few others. So I've always opposed that one because they get an appropriation for the state government just because they're a small city. And I thought, you have other options. So I would move that we oppose item number 3.
Okay. I have a motion and a second to that effect. I'm just going to speak on it for a second. It isn't that I necessarily disagree with you, Mayor. It's just I'm going to lose this battle, and I have other. It isn't worth the fight. I can tell you the votes are where the votes are, and I have other fish I'd like to fry, but I understand your position.
Yeah, I just don't want it to go to the legislature with a unanimous recommendation. I want some opposition on it.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
Aye.
Nay.
Aye.
Okay, I need hands. I have no idea how that ended up. Who was supporting the motion? Okay, I have three.
I don't necessarily agree with
it, but I agree with your position. You don't want to fight the battle.
Yeah.
That's fine.
If we can put more emphasis somewhere else.
Got it.
You're the swing vote?
Then that's where it's going to be.
Thank you, Mayor.
All right.
The motion fails.
All right. Anybody else want to try one? Okay.
Yeah.
Tom?
I don't know where it is now. It looks like it's in a best practice, but are we supporting number four, the mandating the native plant standards?
We are not supporting that. What they're doing is they're asking...
We're supporting moving it to something else, though, aren't we?
It's not recommended, and what we're doing is we're saying to the league, put together best practices. Any city that wants to take this and adopt it locally, they're welcome to do that. But, you know, if people have good native plant standards, have it out there that's on the website, so a city that's looking for the native plant standards that they want to put into place, they can look at somebody else's native plant standards. We do not think that the legislature should be involved in that in any way, shape, or form.
I think that page is confusing. Resolution's not supported. I support not supporting.
I just wanted to make sure that it was, if it drops down to best practices or something, then that's fine.
Yeah, best practices.
I think 23 ought to be opposed on principle because it was three pages long and entirely unintelligible. Dealing with PILTs and Redwood National Parks, and I mean, it was just the most. It's just, I make a motion we oppose it just on principle.
We did.
Oh, we already
they
did
already
oppose
are.
It.
All of those are supporting to oppose.
Oh, yeah, not necessarily recommended that way. Then what we would do is we would discuss it when we discuss the federal agenda.
All right. Have direction, Vice
Yes,
Mayor?
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go on to item number five, acknowledge the receipt of minutes of various boards and committees. Have two. Have a motion by the Vice Mayor and a second by?
Second.
All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Passes. Your reports on meetings and or conferences attended. Let me just, because you read at the bottom in the paper, there was, I think, the first weighted vote in like 14 years at the MAG Regional Council last night. Phoenix called it, and it had to do on the I-10 interest gift to the cities that had committed an obligation to do design and construction. Now went to the legislature, got an appropriation bill drawn up that made them qualify for a $10 million rebate on their commitment to accelerate the freeway. Got real messy because it was money that had already been appropriated through HERF money for other projects, so it rechanged a little bit the direction. Although 10 million out of a billion is not a lot, it was more of a principal issue for us that it opened up the legislative gates to go in and do special legislation for your community to accelerate a different portion of your freeways as opposed to freeways in some other part of the region without doing like Mesa has done and advance the interest cost for that acceleration project. So Phoenix opposed it under the principle. I agreed with them. Weighted vote was called. I think the procedure is first you vote, and I think the vote was maybe, I'm guessing at the number here, unless you have it. 14 to 10 in favor of a $10 million appropriation to three West Valley communities to use for the acceleration of I-10. That would have passed 14 to 10. Then a weighted vote was called, and I think it was like 66% or 70% of the valley via that. 77 to 33 on a population basis. There's 121 points, so it lost. So it did not pass because it lost off in the weighted vote category. So then there was a lot of discussion to try to figure out how and what compromise, if any, could be made. There was at one point a vote to give the West Valley communities $8 million, and that was defeated.
defeated by the West Valley. They didn't want the $8 million. They wanted the full 10, so we went back to $6 million, and that passed. So, yes. Yeah, so it's, I know. So it was an interesting meeting, and it went on for multiple hours. I think we started at 4 or 5 and got out of there about 9 o'clock last night. And some of it was almost the vote by attrition, so but we still had a quorum. So I think it was just lacking a found policy on how to do stand money when it's an appropriation and it's not new money was something that we had not addressed thoroughly enough to have a good policy in place. I agree with the West Valley that I-10 is a project that warrants being completed and widened. And it has multiple ramifications for not just the West Valley, but for the whole state of Arizona. I think I-17 is probably in a similar situation to that, maybe not quite as critical. And we really didn't have the opportunity as the committee to hash that out before all of these proposals were brought forward for. And then that gets complicated because Avondale has an election coming up and there's a mayor running, and so there's a whole lot of other side nuances to this where people felt that they just couldn't compromise and come up with a decision that was compatible with everyone. So I also indicated that if in fact the date for the acceleration money was, I think, June or something of 2007, there was some date that you had to have the program in before, that the only thing Mesa would have to do is roll it back to 2000 and go get our $18 million back, because we accelerated freeways with our bonding to get the Red Mountain, some others done, and I'm not sure that there's that much of a distinction between us accelerating the Red Mountain and them accelerating I-10. We came forward, wanted to do it, and put up our own money to get it done. Now they're trying to have that fully reimbursed by a legislative act. So it was just something I hope we don't start to splinter as a valley and everyone fend for themselves down at the legislature trying to get special bills passed. It was a regional program. It had regional time frames, and it had a 2000 agreement on how projects could be accelerated, and that was the discussion last night, that it was getting murky. And so we wanted to try to pull it back in. So that took a little while to get that resolved, but that was the meeting last night. Vice Mayor.
Thanks, Mayor. That's the interest that we paid on that was out of quality of life tax. Those, the acceleration money, a lot of it was out of the quality of life tax that we got the freeways here earlier. Mm-hmm. Just two things I wanted to comment on. One is that you and Kyle and Rex and I were all at Banner Gateway.
Scott.
I beg your pardon, Scott.
Yeah. I forgot. It's almost my district.
it's almost in Mesa, and there will be an annexation meeting at midnight tonight. Anybody who wants to be there, we got the.
I don't want to be anywhere close to that.
we were at Banner Gateway for the tour of that facility. We're still working with Banner on the reuse of Banner Mesa Medical Center, and they are committed to getting a good reuse there. Downtown Mesa Association does an annual bus tour. I had the opportunity of going on that yesterday morning, and that's always a good event. You get to see the city. It's you know, like those over time maps that you kind of see. And so if you go every year, you get to see what's changed over the course of the year. For those who haven't gone every year, you get some great comments about what they're seeing after not having seen things for 5 or 10 years. And one of the great comments that I heard yesterday was some real estate people who had brought clients to downtown Mesa, who said that it was fabulous. They couldn't get over how wonderful it was. They hadn't been there in more than 10 years. And one of the realtors said to me, I wonder how many of your residents have been to downtown Mesa and have seen what a great and truly authentic downtown this is. They commented on the fact that people go in and they try and build things to look like what we actually have authentically. So it really was nice. We have some great things happening in downtown Mesa. So good things happening all over Mesa. Thank you, Mayor.
Okay. Anyone else? All right. Scheduling of meetings and general information, Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor.
Just remind the Transportation Infrastructure Committee, there's a meeting following this, all our meetings today. And then we'll be having our Monday, August 27th study session and council meeting. We will be canceling the Thursday, August 30th study session. Therefore, on Monday, the 27th, we'll be reviewing, obviously, the agenda that's before you that evening, as well as the September 4th agenda. So just to keep that in mind as we look forward. And we're also going to be having a briefing update on some numbers we have on the drought as far as our water capacities and where we are at that at this point also. So that'll be on the 27th. And then also let me share with you, we want to make sure everyone is aware of this, that Friday, this Friday, let's make sure it's clear, this Friday, August 24th, from 2:30 to 4:30, we'll be having our city clerk, Barbara Jones, retirement farewell, so recognition. So we want to invite the council to that, 2:30 to 4:30 on Friday, August 24th. It will be in the Superstition Ballroom and Rendezvous Center. And presentations will be at 3 p.m. So invite everyone to be there. Barbara has 26 and a half years of service with the city and 17 years as city clerk. So we're certainly going to miss her. Also, Mayor, I also want to make, just under general information, I think this is significant. As we continue to turn more of our attention to what's happening out at Williams Gateway Airport Authority, I'd like to announce that during the past, I think it goes back 2 weeks maybe, since July 23rd, maybe longer than that, last month, the airport has received over $6.3 million in FAA and state ADOT, Department of Transportation funds, both for taxiway improvements as well as drainage improvements. And certainly we think this is great because we continue to receive dollars from the federal government. I think they recognize the importance of of WGA's future. And Mayor, I think certainly your efforts in meeting with the Secretary of Transportation will continue to pay off. And just to inform the council, you may hear this, we are working on updating the master plan at the airport that's required by FAA in order to continue funding. There may be a little confusion about there out in the community about that master plan. That master plan has to be approved. You can't even start a master plan for an airport until the FAA approves you to move forward with a master plan. So it's not really something you initiate on your own. It has to be approved in every step. It's very prescriptive. And we are currently underway with that master plan. And I believe there'll be some modules that will be completed in October. It really won't probably be completed until sometime next year. In addition, obviously, we, from an economic development standpoint, we have the HDR study that's going on that's looking at Williams Airport as well as how that will fit in with the economic development plan, strategic plan in the surrounding area. And that will be completed before June of next year. Thank you very much.
It's kind of like a perfect time to study Gateway with right. The airport going on, all the other studies, they're just coming together and they are not disjointed, so they can kind of talk to one
right.
another. So I appreciate
That's
that.
Exactly, Mayor. And I think not only are we doing those studies, but mm-hmm. we know that many of the property owners, as we found out in the roundtable, are also have consultants that are also looking at how to integrate their developments around the airport. So it's all coming together. I think in the next year we'll have some significant tools to help us in planning further the development around that area.
Right. Any questions?
What time, Monday?
Oh, I think at this time, was it 4:30? 4:30. We'll have a couple of presentations in the two agendas to review.
Okay. Are there any requests to speak this morning?
I have none, Mayor.
Move for adjournment of the study session?
Yes.
Is there a second? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All right, I need to call a special council meeting to order for the purposes of convening an executive session. I have a motion and a second to do so. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All right, okay, we are in executive session.